I'd like to welcome you to Tuesday evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education. I'm so glad you could all make it tonight. Tuesday evenings is an ongoing lecture series. I think many of you know that we run approximately 10 weeks every semester. We're on the school schedule. And we are in week three, and I have to say that it has already been incredibly interesting. We opened, as some of you know, with Kehinde Wiley, which is the subject, his work being the subject of the exhibition we have upstairs, and the curator for that exhibition, Dr. Eugenie Tsai. It was kind of a thrilling way to begin. Then last week, we had something unusual. We had Latasha and Nevada Diggs here, and she performed her work. She's a poet and a sound artist, and she performed her work from her book Twerk, which is so interesting. It's a collection of her poetry, and it's just really good. And she also performed five poems that she had produced in response to the work of Kehinde Wiley, two of which are essays, I guess you would call them, for the catalog. So I'm kind of indebted to Wiley for introducing me to Latasha. And then next week, we are doing something a little different as well, and it's also another nod to Kehinde Wiley. We are breaking with the usual 7 to 8 p.m. lecture format to show the 1983 film Sans Soleil by the artist, filmmaker, and poet Chris Marker, who passed away in 2012. According to Molly Nesbitt's catalog for the Kehinde Wiley exhibition, Wiley credited the film with influencing his world stage paintings. But really, to tell you the truth, just any excuse would do just to show Marker's brilliant travelogue that stretches the genre of documentary. And I don't know if you've seen it, but even if you have, it's this roaming roaming the globe kind of piece that reflects on memory, time, and travel. And the result is a film that is, I think, as poetic as it is cinematic. If you have seen it, I have to tell you, seeing it on this screen in this space is kind of sublime. So I invite you back next week for that. Due to the length of the film, the Tuesday evening lecture series, which is generally 7 to 8, will be 7 to 9 p.m. There will be a brief introduction. Since Marker's not here, we couldn't get Marker, so I will do my best to introduce, to do justice to the film and introduce it very briefly, and then hopefully there'll be a little time for discussion afterwards, but mostly it'll be just getting to submerge yourself in the film Sans Soleil. Tonight, we are fortunate to have Andrea Hickey, curator of the Public Art Fund in New York, with us to shed some light on the shifting nature of the art object from the sanctioned art spaces of galleries and museums to the unyielding context of the public realm. In her position with the Public Art Fund, Andrea has curated exhibitions throughout New York with an incredibly impressive list of individual artists, as well as extremely innovative group exhibitions. Most recently, she's curated Image Objects, which is on view at City Hall Park until November 20th for any of you that happen to be in New York in the near future. I also came across some good reviews on the exhibition, including one by Ken Johnson on July 16th, if you want to go back and find it in the New York Times. Prior to working for the Public Art Fund, Andrea was curator at Art in General, which is a nonprofit gallery in Lower Manhattan. And then from 2007 to 2010, she was curatorial fellow in the Department of Visual Arts at the Walker Arts Center, with an MFA from Concordia University in Montreal. Andrea Hickey established herself early as an independent curator and writer in Montreal and Newfoundland. Her written work has been published in a wide variety of journals and exhibition catalogs, and she continues to pursue her personal interests through various independent curatorial endeavors. And I have to share with you that an email announcement for a group exhibition, Objects, Food, Rooms, curated by Andrea Hickey, at Tanya Bonagdar Gallery in New York last spring or summer, I can't recall, but anyway, I was rolling through my inbox, and it just stopped me cold. And I, you know, getting so much of those kind of emails, I thought I'd better take note. And I was really taken with Andrea's curatorial sensibilities, looking to Gertrude Stein's Tender Buttons for inspiration for the exhibition. She had written in the press release, Stein's prose has a close relationship to how we encounter sculpture today, in the way artists are creating material and found object compositions that transform recognizable things into something else. You can't always articulate what this new object is exactly, but in recognizing things within it, you engage with the narrative of composition itself. Andrea is an interesting and serious thinker, and that is why I could not resist extending the invitation. For tonight's presentation, The Public Object, on sculpture and thingness in public space, she has thoughtfully proposed three questions. What makes an object a sculpture? What makes a thing recognizable as art? And how does the public realm shape these questions differently than the white cube? So let's get on with it. Please join me in welcoming Andrea Hickey.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you, Terry. That was a very lovely introduction. And so nice to hear that those random press releases that you send out are actually read by somebody and thought about, because they do take up your time and your headspace, and it's really wonderful to hear that it reached you here in Fort Worth. So I'm really happy to be part of this weekly lecture series, and delighted to be at the museum for the first time and also in Texas for the first time. So thank you for that opportunity as well. So as Terry mentioned, the focus of my lecture will be specifically about the shifting nature of sculpture as it moves from the gallery space to the public realm, which is a subject I'm exploring throughout my work, both at the Public Art Fund and through my studio visits and in my independent projects as well. Working in the public realm has really challenged me to think differently about the nature of things or objects and when they are designated as sculptures. As you can imagine, I spend a lot of time walking around galleries, thinking and wondering how the sculptures I encounter might look at one of the sites I curate in New York, how they might succeed and how they might fail. But before I get too deeply into that question, to give you a sense of my role as a public art curator, I'd like to give you a brief overview of what I do at the Public Art Fund, our mission, and how we work within the parameters of New York City. I have to use this thing. I'm reading tonight. I don't usually read, but I have a lot of complicated ideas I wanted to talk about. So bear with me. We'll get to some discussion towards the end. But here we go with Public Art Fund. The Public Art Fund, we're a nonprofit organization. We were founded by Doris Friedman in 1977. We work closely with many city departments as well as cultural institutions, and despite our name, which has the word fund in it, we do not give grants, and we are very much a nonprofit. It's an unfortunate name from the 70s that has since carried this legacy of people asking me on studio visits if they can apply for a grant. No. We take a curatorial approach to presenting dynamic contemporary art by local and international artists throughout the city. With each project, our hope is that we can offer the public a powerful and engaging experience with art in urban space. And it's that word powerful that I really want to get at later tonight. ultimately, as part of that work, we also work with artists to provide them with the context they need to engage with the fabric of the city. Since its inception, Public Art Fund has presented more than 400 artist exhibitions and projects at sites throughout New York's five boroughs, making it possible for artists to engage diverse audiences and, along the way, redefine what public art means in relation to the changing nature of contemporary art. Early Public Art Fund projects include Messages to the Public, perhaps one of our most iconic projects, which ran from 1982 to 1990 and was an 800-square-foot animated light board in Times Square and featured almost 70 artists, among them the Gorilla Girls, Keith Haring, Jenny Holzer, Richard Prince, Kiki Smith, David Wanarovich, and so many others. There's actually a great search engine on our website where you can look at all of the artists that we've worked with, and there are actual slides that have been digitized of all of our Messages to the Public projects, and they're very special and very innovative, especially for that time. When you think about how artists are using new media now, this was really at the forefront. More recently, we have presented iconic exhibitions that maybe you've seen on your visit to New York, such as Olafur Eliasson's The New York City Waterfalls, where he made three fake waterfalls off the Brooklyn Bridge. Tatsu Nishi, Discovering Columbus, where the artist created a small New York-style apartment around the Statue of Columbus at Columbus Circle, which completely transformed the way people see the city and saw a monument and understood a relationship to a statue. And this year, we are so happy to be presenting Yeppe Hines' Please Touch the Art, which has brought so many people to Brooklyn Bridge Park to experience his social sculptures, these benches that really have become the property of people who visit the park and how they like to play and navigate the park, as well as his appearing rooms, which is a fountain that is on a timer and the water itself makes an architectural space that you can be inside of or exposed from. And I think with the hot summer we had, people just really wanted to get wet. So Public Art Fund, the way we work right now, we're focused on a number of core sites throughout the city in which our partnerships with various custodial bodies like the New York City Parks Department or a corporate entity or a private park provide us with a really incredible opportunity to present very ambitious projects and new works by contemporary artists. Each core site presents distinctive parameters and opportunities within urban space, and these most often invite a conversation about the nature of sited sculpture in the public realm. We're very different from other public art presenters in New York City in that we are very much focused on sculpture, and this is the nature of my talk tonight. So I'll go into a little detail about some of the core sites that have come to really represent what we do in New York. Doris C. Friedman Plaza is at the entrance of Central Park, which is at 60th and 5th near the Plaza Hotel, or the Mac store, if you know New York a little bit. And it's really been a longstanding site where we've presented new work. Its namesake, Doris C. Friedman, was the founder of Public Art Fund, and she was a very special champion of public art. She served as the city's first director of cultural affairs. She was president of the Municipal Arts Society, and she actually started the Percent for Art program in New York, which was really an enormous coup at the time. Over the past several years, we presented a really diverse group of new commissions by international artists at this site. This is Franz Vest, who I personally consider to be the godfather of public sculpture. I think a lot of people would agree. We've also presented really different kind of works that have expanded an artist's practice. Michael Salesdorfer's Tornado, which is made from transport truck tire inner tubes, and we're going to talk about tires later. Italian artist Paolo Pivi proposed a spinning airplane, which actually did spin outside of Central Park. The Polish artist Monika Sosnowska created a fir tree from a replica of a staircase from the exterior of an Eastern European housing block fire escape. Olaf Bruning created a massive sculpture of clouds based on a photograph that he had made a couple of years before, which became a kind of iconographic backdrop to, I don't know how many Instagram photos of tourists, if any of you have seen that, trolling around your social media feeds. And most recently, this summer, we presented Tatiana Truve's Desire Lines, which was a sculptural presentation that, with each spool, referenced the line, exact measurement of a pathway in Central Park, and was named for a particular icon or person or story related to the history of walking. So it was a very evocative piece, despite being a quite stable sculpture. We also work in Rockefeller Center, where we have been known to present very large-scale new commissions for about a month each spring. We work closely with Tishman Speyer there, and one of our, I think, most beloved projects was Jeff Koons Puppy, which we recently realized a split rocker in honor of his retrospective. You might also know Ugo Rondinone's Human Nature, a nine-figure massive rock sculpture exhibition that really dominated the thoroughfare of Rock Center for about 2 months. And this summer we presented Thomas Hausigo masks. We actually have a new piece in the works that I'd love to tell you about because it's fantastic, but I am forbidden. It will soon be announced, but it is going to be an exciting piece. We also work in Brooklyn Bridge Park and Metrotech, our two Brooklyn core sites. Brooklyn Bridge Park is a new park that has opened in 2012. Our first project was with Oscar Tuazon when the park was still in construction, and it was wonderful to be able to work with him to create a series of works that really address the idea of play and interaction, but still very much continued within the materials and aesthetic he was exploring in his work in other locations. We also presented Jan Vo's We the People last summer, and of course I mentioned Yepa's piece already. Metrotech is one of our oldest sites. It's if you ever take the subway to Brooklyn when you visit, there's a subway stop called Metrotech J Street. And if you go upstairs, there's a very 90s style corporate plaza that was really built to exclude the exterior community. And part of our work there has been about opening up that space and showing the public new kinds of artworks, major projects, and really bringing people inside the space and kind of creating a new relationship between downtown Brooklyn and this space. Right now we have Hank Willis Thomas, The Truth Is I See You, which is a fantastic project with a number of truisms translated in, I think, all of the languages that are spoken in Brooklyn and presented in a number of different formats, including these signs that are in English in one direction and then translated into various languages in the other direction. The last core site I'll talk about is City Hall Park. It's located next to City Hall. It's at the border of the Financial District, Chinatown, and Tribeca, and it's adjacent to the Brooklyn Bridge. This park has been home to a number of incredible exhibitions, and the Victorian-style design of the park and its divided lawns and pathways provide a unique kind of outdoor gallery. I think what's interesting about this space is that it's really been about showing very individual sculptures under a specific theme, and the idea of an outdoor group exhibition I think is very challenging from a curatorial perspective, but also really addresses the nature of sculpture outside because the works are not so much about enormity of scale or filling a space up. They're very much about sculpture as sculpture. We did a wonderful Saul LeWitt retrospective of his outdoor works in this space that was kind of different than what I just spoke about, but definitely an outlier. We've shown some performance work there, and I'll talk a little bit more about the show that's on view there towards the end of my lecture. So I'll just pause for a second. I think having seen now a few of the works we've done and the kind of projects we've been engaged with over the past few years, you might understand that commissioning temporary public sculpture is a really tricky business. There are a lot of complex circumstances, the most obvious which are the pragmatic issues of public safety, weather conditions, vandalism, not to mention questions about how the work is fabricated, how does the site itself hold it up, how do you engineer the right kind of base for this kind of massive sculpture, or in this specific case, how do you make sure there's a blow-up machine available at all hours of the day if it deflates? What if somebody sticks a pin in it? We had a series of inflatables where somebody actually would tweet, inflatable down. So, you know, these are questions that are part of the feasibility, part of our process that, you know, make for the logistic part of the tricky business. But I think for me, from a curatorial perspective, a really more complicated matter is how an artist might develop a powerful proposal, one that has an impactful relationship to the surroundings, like the skyscrapers, the traffic, the LED screens, the smartphones. The smartphones, it's really a big deal. In New York, if you spend time there, people do not look up from their phones. How can I ever get them to look at a sculpture if I can't get them to not bang into me? So, you know, these are big questions. How does sculpture actually work in these urban environments? How do we actually say that art is worth people stopping what they're doing in their everyday and paying attention? I think that, I mean, that's my ultimate goal, is to ask somebody to just pay attention. And if they can look twice, you know, beyond paying attention, then I've really won. So all this means that thinking about the nature of a powerful artwork in public space has led me to really think about the relationship between the contemporary art and the urban environment. I've come to see that sculpture does not move easily from the gallery to the street, and that the inverse is also true. The street can move easily into the gallery. This is a pull from an Instagram feed that I really enjoy. It's actually the editor of ArtNet or ArtInfo, Scott Andresic. For those of you who know him, maybe his Instagram feed is called UniChloe. I promised him I would credit him about this. But he has this hashtag called Mattresses of New York, and I love it because I walk around New York thinking, this is totally an artwork. Is this not an Oscar Toussaint? Is this not a Sarah Lucas? And then he also captions them, which I think are hilarious, because here we've got Sarah Lucas. This illustrates my point so well. We've got garbage, gallery, same material. So in this relationship between the street or the things in our environment, actual objects that we know every day, like our you know, our construction sites, and then the art object has relative and meaningful shifts in how we understand different sculpture differently in the public realm versus the gallery space. I think what I'm saying might sound very obvious, but the reality is that we don't actually think about this very carefully, because not very many people are actually moving their work from indoors to outdoors on a regular basis. So the very nature of what an object is never really discussed in this way. So as I mentioned, if you're involved in art, even distantly, or even if you're just like a poetic person that read that Rebecca Solnit book about walking or getting lost, you might spend time walking and seeing everything around you, and noticing, like, this could be a sculpture. This could be an artwork. The things in our back alleys, in our construction sites, they make their way into sculptures that use assemblage and found objects to create new kinds of form. So while the objects often remain the same, a tire is a tire. Told you I was going to talk about tires. The meaning of the object completely changes for the viewer when encountered on a street corner versus a gallery presentation. This is a fantastic show that Mike Nelson did. This is the power plant version. I saw it at Casey Kaplan. I love his work. He's always using found objects. He's also using fake found objects. And his work in the gallery space is so completely not just about the tire, but there's a similarity, and how do we talk about that? I'd like to suggest that the ability or inability of the object, let's say the tire, to remain an art object when it is returned to the street. So imagine this in the street as a public art object. After it's been placed in the gallery, so now it's in the gallery, it's been ratified, it's like a real art object, we put it in the gallery, then we're going to move it back outside. Imagine how that's going to function. It asks us really important questions about how sculpture maintains its autonomy or its affect on the viewer. So through this process of found object, gallery, street. Found object being originally maybe on the street. So the art object tire, sorry, I got ahead of myself because I stopped reading. My point is that when it's back in the public art presentation realm, it becomes a discarded and unimportant object again. You know, it doesn't look so different from this. And so many works that I love, they would never be able to function outside because they return to their found object status. I think this presents a really fantastic challenge to our art historical reliance on the ready-made as an always ironic gesture. And it asks us to consider how an object or a thing that we know can function in sculpture outside of this dichotomy. So it sort of breaks the whole ready-made cycle open. I think we can start thinking about the nature of the artist's relationship to the thing as a non-ready-made form, and thus we start to think about the power and efficacy of the art object to reach beyond the insular discourses of the art world, which as a public art curator is my ultimate goal. And as I've said before, throughout my recent work, I've been interested in exploring how sculpture communicates to the viewer differently inside the space of a gallery and how it might be transformed in the public context. So all of this has been really deeply informed by a lot of conversations that I've had with people like Oscar, who use wonderful industrial materials and operate very easily between public and private space or gallery space and the public realm, and Virginia Overton likewise. I work constantly on proposals with artists that take a long time, like 3 years of talking about how their sculptures can move from the gallery to the street. Mark Maunders is a dear friend and a wonderful artist, and I'd like to share a particularly inspiring story that he relayed to me during a studio visit and was later part of the catalog of the Venice Biennial, and he spoke about it in a lecture we did at Public Art Fund. I'm sure you know his work. He's a prolific sculptor, and he has a very acute sense of the psychological effect an object might have on a viewer. He lives in a very tiny town outside of Ghent. This is a picture of him in his amazing studio. He kind of lives a kind of reclusive life. And before he knows whether or not a work is ready for the viewer, he likes to place that work in his local grocery store and look at it in a real-life context one that is unprotected and exposed from the white walls of the gallery. His thinking is, if it works in the grocery store, it'll totally work in the gallery. Which I think is absolutely true and very special and important. And I think an interesting side note here is that Mark never uses a found object. He will make his own screws. If he wants to use newspaper, he will make a newspaper. He will print newspaper, rather than have the found object be a referent to something else. So that's an important thing to think about in his work. He's got the sensibility that understands the protection of the gallery space and also a very acute sensibility about the materials he's using. So for me, Mark's story speaks to the dynamic and interdependent relationship between sight and sculpture, and perhaps also the effect that a public space might have on the readability or measure of successful affect an object might have, wherever it goes in the end. So switching gears a little bit, this summer I organized two exhibitions, one outside and one inside. They literally opened one day after another. It was very exhausting. But it was also really interesting to do those two projects at the same time. They explored questions about sculpture's relationship to found objects and about public space, among a myriad of other things. But the outdoor exhibition, Image Objects, which I'll talk about later, took sculpture's relationship to digital transformation as its premise and was deeply inspired by the work of a so-called generation of post-internet artists, which I've found to be very fascinating because I don't know if it's the age or where exactly or the kind of schooling these artists are coming out of. They do not have the same baggage of art history when they're making their work, and it's very fascinating, especially when thinking about how they might work in public space. Simultaneously, I developed an exhibition for Tanya Banokhtar, which Terry so generously spoke about, called Objects, Food, and Rooms, that used Gertrude Stein's book Tender Buttons as an organizing principle to investigate the relationship between sculpture and recognizable things, or in other words, this kind of semiotics of form. While the subject matter of each show was very different, both exhibitions presented perspectives about the relationship between the thing or found object, how it is transformed into a sculptural object, and how our encounters with these compositions differ in the gallery and in the public realm. So I'm going to start first with the gallery exhibition, as the works in this show illustrate an important question about how the found object or thing is incorporated into sculpture and function in a different way than the ready-made has in the past. As I noted earlier, when tracing out the relationship between things in the street making their way into the gallery, in contemporary sculpture, I see this as having much more to do with making a composition and telling a story than asserting that a thing is an art object because of its placement in the gallery, which is such a wonderful thing. Are we not so tired of that conversation? That said, the question of what it is not easily answered in the gallery space. What we might describe as a homeless person's left belongings is something else in the gallery. How would we describe this object? I think it's a fantastic Rachel Harrison piece. I could probably pick it out of a crowd as a Rachel Harrison, but could I really, if I had to explain it to my mom, who lives in Newfoundland and really doesn't care about sculpture, how could I say what this is? And I could say it's like something. It might be nearly something else. And seeing that across a breadth of artists' work was such a fascinating experience, especially as somebody who's deeply interested in language. And I found that Gertrude Stein's incredibly complicated text, although it was written in 1910, illustrates a still very relevant, complex relationship between a thing and the words that might describe it. Actually, maybe even more relevant than at that time. In some ways, I could imagine contemporary sculpture always being best described in the kind of suggestive, poetic proximates that Stein articulates. I'm going to read a little brief Stein quote from Tender Buttons, just so you have a sense of what I'm talking about. The book is divided into three sections: objects, is sort of a prose poetry book, and food objects are about, you know, sort of domestic things, and food is, each section is titled about a particular food, like roast beef or an apple, and then the last section, things sort of all come together in this title, Rooms. So this is called A Mounted Umbrella. What was the use of not leaving it there where it would hang? What was the use if there was no chance of ever seeing it come there and show that it was handsome and right in the way it showed it? The lesson is to learn that it does not show it, that it shows it, and that nothing, that there is nothing, that there is no more to do about it, and just so much more, there is plenty of reason for making an exchange. It's also, that particular phrase is nicely meta for what we're talking about. But the artists included in objects, food, and rooms played on this idea, and they specifically sought out works that included or referenced, or I specifically sought out works that included or referenced real things, either including them directly, as in Laura Provost's piece. This is a series of objects accompanied by texts where she sort of enlivens a very domestic object with her own narrative. So the combination of soap and sponge or carpet or ball of tape really has an associative linguistic framework. Or Darren Bader, whose work you can see in the table here, he, you know, this is a table. The instructions are to find a desk, and I had to borrow the T-shirt, which is part of the piece, a ceramic rooster, a samosa, and there's another food item on there, and a printout text that he had written, and it sort of plays with, as you read the text, the kind of composition that emerges in the relationship between the objects that he's put together. Very Dada in a Darren Bader sort of take the piss out of you way. Other artists were playing with the idea of found objects in a very different way. Rula Partenu, who's a young Canadian artist, actually recreated all of these objects using MDF and paint. And few of the objects are actually real, but they are so uncannily similar that there is a wonderful tension in the exhibition. This is also a banana that was broken, I think, 4 times during the show because it looks so real. Other artists really transformed objects. So Frank is using composition, combining wood block with this form of a squash that's bent that looks like a swan. Then Arlene Sheckett's stacks of clay works that kind of merge into each other, things that she's found in her studio. Nari Bagramian, who I think is a really fantastic artist and also really gets to the core of what I'm talking about. This is a piece called Waste Basket, but it's actually chicken wire and melted latex. So how do we describe this piece? Do we describe it as a waste basket? Do we describe it by its materials? I think the actual title of the piece is Empty Vessel for Bad Ideas or something like that. So I think all of these things need to be addressed in a more detailed way than we are sort of skimming over them. For me, the narrative composition of many of these objects functioned almost like a three-dimensional tableau or image. So in my mind, we look at these objects or we encounter them the way that we would read. So I'm not talking about narrative in the sense of storytelling, although I did say that word earlier. I'm talking about narrativity, which is basically, I don't know if anybody's read Walter Ong or sort of linguistic approach to narrativity, but the idea of what are the smallest elements that make a sentence? And for me, we read images very much in this way, and that's how we come to understand what we're looking at. And the kind of composition that exists in these sculptures, I think we read it in the same way we would read an image. So they not so much become a flat image, but we engage in a very narrative process that is very much about language or pointing to a referent. For example, the sausages in Rachel's cart, They're food items, but they're also metaphorical pointing devices to other meanings. This piece is really figurative. It's very male. There's a sausage. You know, you can take it from there. Sorry, I skipped ahead of myself. I'd like to suggest the way we see and navigate visual pointing devices, be they objects or images, is really in a state of flux because our way of reading and absorbing knowledge continues to change at a rapid rate because of new forms of technology, particularly related to sight and text. Google Image being Google Image Search being one of them, or the idea of tagging something. So we're kind of creating a shorthand, a visual shorthand for metaphorical meaning, in a way that's much quicker and homogeneous than it would have been in the past. So in my mind, sculpture today is very connected to that way of thinking about images and composition and reference points, even though it's very separate from anything electronic. And ironically, this way of making meaning, or the shorthand of seeing and understanding, is the very thing that negates the possibility of understanding these works as sculptures in the public realm. As with the tire, the composition that the object creates in the public realm is quickly read simply as detritus. Or, as Stein would say, a rose is a rose is a rose. If you saw this outside, you'd think it was garbage. In the case of public space, the shorthand works against the possibility of meaning in the work because of its visual surroundings. And as a caveat to this, because I do love all of the artists that I was speaking about, I don't want to say that these artists are not able to produce amazing public art. In fact, many of them have created great public works, and my interest in them is really a testament to their dexterity as artists and their complex understanding of the nature of sculpture today. They can switch gears. So me saying, Rachel, this would never work in public space, she would never think about putting it there. Did you see this magical piece that she did as part of the Nasher Commission? She really gets the idea of pointing. But getting back to the narrative impulse we bring to viewing sculpture, the current exhibition at City Hall Park in New York, Image Objects, is a show which played with the idea that through digital technology, images and objects might find themselves in a cyclical relationship. The artists in this show created new forms by translating objects into digital files that were then manipulated and transformed to create a new object for fabrication, which would then become, once again, a two-dimensional image as photography of the work is shared and distributed online. When we leave here, and you have access to your Instagram feed or whatever, I encourage you to look up the hashtag for this exhibition. So, at Public Art Fund or hashtag image objects, and you can see how these works are being filtered and translated outside of the exhibition official photography, which I think is very fascinating because it also puts the viewer in a very important position of power in how they edit and share that image or crop it. It's very participatory. But to get a little specific in what I'm talking about, this cyclical relationship, Alice Channer. These are a series of works called Rockfall, and to make this work, Alice actually found a piece of rubble outside of her studio, like man-made cement, that she then scanned using a 3D scanner, and then stretched using computer software, and then created a cast to cast the object in concrete, in Corten steel, and in aluminum. And then the final work was actually made... No, sorry. This is very confusing for me, too. She 3D scanned it. She manipulated the image digitally. Then that image was 3D printed. It was expanded, and then they used a special CNC router. Everybody is using CNC routers now. Do you guys use CNC routers? Anyway, it's basically a carving machine that you can send digital information to that will recreate a sculpture for you. so you no longer have to carve anything yourself. But what was interesting, so the piece was carved and then it was cast in these different materials, but what you see is sort of uncanny because it's rocks. People hang out in this park as if they're hanging out on these rock benches, but you can see that they're not real. You can see the edges of the CNC router carving machine, which is not perfect unless you sand it afterwards. John Raffman did something very different or similar. Sorry, he used a CNC router to carve marble busts that he digitally manipulated. So these start out as actual, you know, classical busts that are then kind of twisted in computer software program, and then that digital information is given to the machine in Carrara, where they were once manufacturing classical sculptures. They're also using CNC routers. Arti Verkant, who is very much an inspiration for this show and also coined this word image object, he's got a great essay called Image Objects that's online. He took this cube and cut it in digital space and then transposed an image atop it that when it's documented kind of changes the form. So from every perspective, as you walk around this piece, it looks like a different object. So he's actually made the piece thinking about how it will be photographed. The photograph is actually more important than the piece itself. And Hank Willis Thomas, as you may know, is an artist that's been mining photography throughout his work, has recently started to cut pieces of the photograph and transpose them into new settings through sculptural manipulation. So in each of these works, the object of origin, a piece of rubble, a marble bust, a steel cube, an arm, a basketball, the thing is still there, but it also functions as a referent and a pointing device. It isn't the object itself it is transformed and is there for something new. While different in terms of formal considerations, this gesture functions in a similar way to that of a compositional mode of sculpture incorporating found objects. So in my mind, these are very different looking sculptures, but I think the impetus and the gesture is similar. The thing we are observing holds within its form the narrative of its own making. It is not quite a rock or a bust or a cube, yet in its transformation, it's different. It calls attention to itself and the meaning of the use of the thing within the work, rather than the thing itself. As we might say in the case of Nari's waste basket, where it placed inside the park. As viewers, when we look at things in public space and then again in the gallery, we can ask ourselves what the meaning of the thing is rather than why is this here. I think these questions are very important for how we encounter sculpture today and how we decide what is something that's authentic and important and really worth investigating and what is really just a conversation with itself and with the discourses of art history. And I think when you really move things into the public realm, as I was saying earlier, it calls the bluff on both sides of the conversation. So I think maybe that's a nice place to end. And I'm interested in all of your feedback and questions because it's something that I'm really working out for myself. And I think I'm sort of in a unique position because I'm thinking in both of these spaces. So I know probably some of you are more attuned to one space or to the other. So please call me on anything. There are quite a lot of loopholes.
I want to jump right in with the conversation. I'm sure this is something that you've thought about, but what is the role, to your mind, of disruption in our expectations of art? You know, the notion of the ready-made working within the gallery space because it's a disruption.
Oh, that's a great word to think about. I don't think the ready-made is any longer a disruption.
Right, exactly.
And I think that's the problem with it. It's levels of irony have sort of it's like a snake eating its own tail. I think we need to think about sculpture that uses found objects in a different way. And I think thinking about how disruption works in public space forced me to think about sculpture inside the gallery in a different way, because it would never work outside. So it really exposed the vulnerability of those objects, which I think a lot of very great sculptors are aware of in their work, and they're self-reflective of it, and there is a potent vulnerability there that indicates that it's not about a ready-made. But I think when you translate or think about translating a form to outside, the disruption is not enough. It doesn't disrupt.
So I think that seems like that's the problem to me too. But what you're proposing is not that the use of the ready-made no longer works, but that in fact our expectations of it, our expectations of it and the way we talk about it is not jiving with the way the work actually operates.
Exactly. I think it's misread. And I think the intention of the ready-made no longer needs to be part of the art historical discourse or dialogue around found objects. But I think because the art world is so insular and it's such a protected box, that any time you put a thing in a room, you cannot escape that narrative. And what's exciting about working with artists who are of this post-internet generation is they don't care about the narrative. They don't even really know about it. If they do, they think it's, you know, not important, and they're moving on to something else, and their work doesn't even really address it. But what's interesting is you'll start to see these artists that are part of that dialogue are now making work that looks a lot like Isa Genskin's. So there is some kind of similarity happening there, and I'm curious about what can be teased out from those approaches. Does that answer your question? It's a hard question to answer.
It was a good discussion. That was good.
A very good lecture.
Thank you.
You mentioned some books and you mentioned some hashtags. Would you put them somewhere in the internet or send an email so that we could...
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll get them up,
yeah,
on the,
for sure.
On the side. I have one more question. How did you come from Newfoundland?
That's a long story. It just happened. I got into art. You can't really do art there forever. There's not so much happening in the visual arts world. Actually, there is. There's a great new residency. Everyone should apply for it at Fogo Island. I'm speaking about it next week in New York. In the back.
I have a question about your relationship with the owners of the parks.
Yeah.
Properties where you're placing the work. To what extent do they get involved in proving what you're going to show there, or do they give you free rein? And my second question is, what's the most controversial piece you've ever put in a public place in New York City?
Probably the most controversial piece you've never seen. No, our relationships with our partners. I mean, one of the reasons we work in these core sites is that we've, you know, developed these relationships over so many years that we do have a kind of special relationship with the site keepers, and those are different departments, the Parks Department or City Hall or Brooklyn Bridge Park is a private public park. It's an interesting combo. There is absolutely an approval process, but we kind of take pride in the fact that we already know our partners so well that we would know how to vet what they would vet. We haven't really had too many, we've never really been turned down, but we would never propose something that would be turned down. Most of the concerns that we've had in terms of revising proposals have been around climbing issues. Because whatever you put out, someone will climb to the top of it. It can be like suicidal, but they will. So we often have to create situations where it looks like you shouldn't climb it. But our partners are very generous and wonderful. And so, you know, Brooklyn Bridge Park, we're allowed to be on site for 3 weeks to install if we want, which is really special for an artist who might be really like Oscar wanting to build a piece on site. Other things we have to do in the middle of the night, like George Friedman Plaza. I've been there several Februaries at 3 a.m. in the freezing cold, which is really awful part of my job. So, yeah, are the most controversial. You know, one of my first pieces I showed for a group show in Metro Tech was a Young Hae Chang Heavy Industries video piece. And it had some, like, sexual innuendo language. And I had to ask them to rephrase their words because anything directly sexual, we can't really present in the public realm because it's not like in a museum where you can say parental guidance required. We do have to be sensitive to parents and kids and that kind of thing.
How did the artists respond?
They were actually really open and understanding. They'd done a lot of work in public space before. Most people understand some of the basic parameters. You know, we don't want to show things that the New York Post is going to, like, totally turn into something crazy. So we're careful around things like that. Red shirt in the back, and then there's black shirt in the middle.
As you did this, another level of the found object assembly comes to mind, and that is where artists have made assemblies of found objects or maybe objects that are almost unrecognizable, just detritus, and then put another layer of valuation on it by casting it in bronze. What do you think that says about this?
I think that's something I especially encounter in this field, is this idea that you take your work and you just make it into bronze. And in my mind, it doesn't work. I don't think it... But yeah, it's a challenging question given the argument that I set up. It's not necessarily about the materiality. What I'm trying to say is that it's the actual thing. So, like, if we cast this in bronze, we can put it outside because it won't, you know, rot or whatever. I guess this wouldn't rot either. But it would look like an art object because it would be in a different material. So in my argument, transforming it enough to make it a different material makes it an art object. So...
But back in the 60s, if you did that...
Right.
Valentine beer can.
But you'd have to make it big, or you'd have to transform it more. You have to make, for even if you look back on those works, they weren't just taking the one for one. There, I could have talked a lot more about the idea of transformation and spectacle. For it to disrupt in public space, in my mind, the material transformation is not enough. It would have to be transformed in another way. So that's why you get Daddy's Ketchup. It's materially transformed, but it's also scale. So it has enough of a presence that it disrupts your knowledge of it as water bottle or whatever, you know.
Lipstick,
right. Sylvie Fleury has the big giant lipsticks. You know, there's a lot, like Klaus Oldenburg is a perfect example. You know, the idea of blowing up the found object made it a different kind of thing. It was no...
I think that Klaus Oldenburg is a little bit
over the top.
Stale at this point.
He's a little bit what?
Stale.
Totally. Well, actually, no. I think he's a great public artist. But I'm using him as an example to prove a kind of logic argument. But I mean... If you're talking about whether or not something's successful now, I still think I showed a piece with David Shrinkley that was so simple. It was a cast steel pair of flip-flops. But the transformation of material made the object really dumb and amazing. So it had a conceptual flip in the change in material because of its usability. So for it to be successful, still maintain its objecthood in the same scale, for me it would also have to have the third thing, which would be playing with like use, of, which is again changing narrative of how you would encounter that object. I'm working through this. It's not totally resolved. Oh, we had middle black shirt.
Yes, because you have a relationship with your core sites, I would imagine that you also have a regular public audience that has a certain expectation for what they will see in those sites. So do you, and I thought it was really wonderful what you said about people not just questioning whether where this work comes from, why it's here, but what it means. So do you still get a lot of questions about the work that you do and why it's art or why it's there, or do you see more of questioning of what it means in the way that we would all want to ask that question or discuss that question?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think our goal in having these regularly used sites, our most positive hope, was that people would start to be used to seeing art in them, and so they would be more comfortable with, you know, strange things that were unexpected or more open to more challenging work. I think that's absolutely happened. We obviously get lots of people who, when we're installing, yell at us and say, this is taxpayers' money, blah, blah, blah. It's actually not taxpayers' money at all. But you know, I think that's part of working in public space. But our you know, our New York audience and our even our visitor tourist audience, they do come to expect that kind of work in those sites. And it has allowed us to do pretty experimental things. To play devil's advocate, I would also say that setting up that expectation also kind of creates the same safety of a white cube. And I think our most successful projects are often those that are in unexpected places because they have a different kind of disruption and a different kind of vulnerability and maybe also excitement. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. We want both at the same time. It'll be, you know, this is an experiment we've been doing. I mean, some of the sites we've used for a very long time, but this idea that we regularly program this many sites every single year has been about a 5-6 year experiment, and we're looking at, did it work? I think it did. People seem really excited about what we're doing. So the question is, how do we keep it asking the challenging questions that public art can ask?
Is impermanence part of the power of what you're doing?
Oh, I don't know if it's power, but I know that I think everything I've said would totally change if I was working on permanent public sculpture. I think, you know, if you look at the Spoon Bridge and Cherry, Klaus Oldenburg sculpture in Minneapolis Sculpture Garden, that piece is an icon, and permanence is about monuments and icons. And what we're talking about is about an encounter with an unexpected thing. So, yeah, I think you're right. Impermanence is a huge part of it.
But in the post-internet age, is that looking at that situation in a way that traditional, I mean, in other words, is that just because what we've come to expect of art in public places or public art is monument, or if it's permanent? I mean, it doesn't seem like that fits with the post-internet notion. You know, it doesn't seem like that's moving forward with the way we live our lives and the way we interact with images and ideas.
I would say impermanence does fit with it.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Impermanence does, but is there a way for something that permanence to be more relevant I mean, can permanence exist? Can it be relevant in this day and age?
It'd be very interesting to discuss that with, you know, there's a great artist that lives in Berlin, Oliver Larrick, who's providing free 3D printable pieces from the Metz collection online. You can print it out in your own machine. You know, so I think there are museums that are thinking about that, and the digital archive is very much looking at that. I think that's going to happen soon. I think it would be interesting to see if that would totally change. I don't know if it's possible. Things are changing really fast. What would that mean?
Yeah, I think it has. Yeah, I think the components are different, and it may be what you're saying, that it's not that the work itself has to change. It's that we have to find a different way to look at and to think about and to write about and talk about.
Yeah, I think my concern is a lot about the frameworks, and making connections between, you know, the social context that we're living in and how we see is changing. And if how we see is changing, then how we think about objects is completely changing. I think people are so concerned about the relationship between technology and images that they don't think about technologies and objects. Technologies and objects.
That's great. Does the Public Art Fund do any kind of education programs around the pieces, or has social media kind of done that for you?
Another good question. We are small still. We're growing really fast, but we don't have an education department proper. We do pretty extensive, didactic texts that are mostly online. What we write in public is usually 75 words or less. Our social media campaigns are really a lot about, you know, shedding light on the piece in a new way. We had an Instagram takeover for the Image Objects show that was about how the artist made the piece. So we've done small kinds of educational campaigns. We did an educational guide for Jan Bo's piece, but it is sort of a one-off thing.
Media,
yeah,
helping with the message. How do you measure success for a piece, and what is your measurement for success? You know, engaging with it. How do you determine if a piece works or not?
Well, I think that was sort of my whole lecture, was trying to figure that out. because I think, you know, it's very easy to look at statistics and say, we got X many likes on this piece, or this show was really hot on Instagram, or it was really, like, tweeted about, or whatever, which I think, because we're not a museum with a door, we can't exactly use ticket sales as an indicator. So, I think we're at a point in our organizational history, and we're in a really unique position to say, how do we measure external success? I mean, I have my own feelings about what I think is successful as a curator, but that doesn't mean that I think it's been successful to a public audience. Like, a show, I was actually really worried that the Image Object show wouldn't be accessible, and that the ideas of digital post-internet conversations wouldn't translate to a general public, especially a really quickly moving public. And I was really happy to know that they are much more media savvy than me, and that it was so quickly absorbed. I mean, there were a lot of pieces in the show that were fairly didactic in some ways that helped, I think, some of the more complicated pieces. But yeah, we're not success measurement is challenging for us because we don't have the same kind of museums situations. There's a lot of new writing being done about how to measure success for public art institutions, but that's something we're trying to figure out. There was somebody in the back that had a question. Yeah.
Are you a reader of A Thousand Plateaus? Are you familiar with the discussion of smooth and striated?
Yeah.
And I think the Oldenburg discussion, that are, say, Jeff Koons, for example, transforming an object into a shiny object is in line with the discussion that's already developed there.
True.
And so I think
there's
a philosophy that already underlies your investigation here.
Yeah, I'm trying to get away from using philosophy to talk about art because I think it's part of the problem. I mean, I'm really interested in philosophy as a curator person, but one of the things that I realized working outside is that it doesn't always fit all of the arguments.
It's another box.
It's a different box. Yeah,
you're making your own box.
I'm trying to make my own box without using the D&G.
And of course, you're right around the corner from the Apple box.
Yeah.
Right.
I think that's good. Are you
back? Yeah, we're good. But thank you. That was great.